Tony's not your friend. He's the Prime Minister. And he was trying to tell me something very profound, which is when you get into government, all your relationships change.
He didn't have any of the measures in it at all. I mean, he didn't put any of the policy in. And I kind of went in and said, look, I've got a problem with your speech problem because you haven't put any of the policy in. He said, it's all really unpopular. Why do I want to say any of this? And I said, well, because you're the Chancellor. And if you don't say it, it doesn't happen.
Hello and welcome to Preparing for Power, a special Inside Briefing podcast brought to you by the Institute for Government. The days, weeks and months ahead are going to be dominated by opinion polls and campaign slogans, policy pledges and manifesto launches. But what about the morning after election night? Whoever forms the next government will need to be prepared, and the job begins almost as soon as the votes have been counted. So what's it like to go from opposition to government overnight? How do civil servants get ready for the possibility of a transition of power or of a hung parliament? And what is it like for a governing party to continue in power after a bruising campaign? In this series, the Institute for Government takes you behind the scenes to find out how our politicians, their advisers and officials block out the noise of a general election campaign to get ready for being in government. We'll be speaking to former ministers, special advisers and senior civil servants to discover how they prepared for that all-important election result and its aftermath, to hear their secrets and to work out the lessons for 2024. I'm Emma Norris, Deputy Director at the Institute for Government. In this episode, we'll be looking at what it's like inside government during the first days, weeks and months with a new party in power. A new government will want to hit the ground running. Their political capital may be high, but their understanding of how to deliver their agenda will be at its lowest. We'll be going behind the scenes, speaking to people who were the key players in the first days of a new government in 1997 and 2010. We'll explore what actually happens on a Prime Minister's first day in Number 10, how a new government can make the most of their first months in office, and what it's like for civil servants adjusting to having a new party or parties in charge.
Well, I think one thing that people don't realise, including politicians, is that the UK is always unique in having, frankly, no time for the transition. You go straight from winning election into forming a government and governing, and it's not a very sensible system.
Jonathan Powell was Tony Blair's chief of staff. On the night of the 1997 election, he'd been with Tony Blair in his North East constituency.
We flew down. We went by motorcade to the QE2 centre for the party. I walked back across Westminster Bridge to my flat, completely exhausted. Went to bed about 5, got up at 6, and took a taxi up to Islington, Tony's house. There, Alistair and I and Tony Shree obviously went to the Buckingham Palace, and then from there into Downing Street. And we walked in. Robin Butler welcomed Tony and Shree. Took Tony to the cabinet room to give him his first day briefs in the civil service and to ask him some of the difficult questions about nuclear weapons and all that stuff that happens with a new prime minister. And then we were into it. We had to appoint the cabinet that day. So you end up with an exhausted prime minister and staff who'd been on an election campaign for at least 3 weeks, usually much longer. No sleep that particular night, then forcing them to take decisions about nuclear weapons, who's in the government and how the country's going to be run. It's not ideal.
10 Downing Street isn't just the incoming prime minister's office. It's also where they and their family will live, as former Cabinet Secretary Gus O'Donnell told us.
This came home to me very much when David Cameron came in 2010. And I meet the incoming Prime Minister at the door, shake hands, welcome the spouse. The Prime Minister is then clapped through. I whiz round the back and greet the new Prime Minister in the Cabinet room. And David Cameron very kindly gave me a picture at the end that his photographer taken of him with his head in his hands. And he's just realised, oh my God, I'm Prime Minister. And beside him is a picture of Sam, his wife, pregnant. So, you know, not only have we got the stress of new, hardest job in the world in many respects, changing where he lives, and, you know, new member of the family coming along. And I'm about to give him questions about precisely how many people would he like us to blow up in the event of a nuclear entanglement. So, yeah, it's tough.
But the work begins as soon as they've entered their new front door.
First of all, you're doing the nuclear stuff, which is basically you're giving him an envelope and he is going to decide in the event that no one, you know, we've been obliterated, Westminster's been obliterated, London, what our nuclear submarines should target. And this is put in an envelope, sealed. I don't know what's in it. I've never known what anyone's in it, but it's sealed. It's taken to the submarines. So there's always, you know, under our principle of CASD, continuous at sea deterrence, they're locked away in a safe. And in the event that there is something nuclear, they open the safe and they will do what it says. And that's a massive decision, you know. And I've always said to prime ministers, think carefully if you want to wait, you know, if you want to have some briefings on this, you know. And so I've no idea. The only thing I have to say to them, of course, is until such time as you fill in the envelope and it goes off, whatever your predecessor decided is what's going to happen. So that does create a sense of more urgency. Let's put it that way.
The questions of nuclear deterrent are just the start of a series of important decisions and meetings for a prime minister on their first day.
How are we going to operate? The way in which we're going to talk about things, how the individual likes to work, where they want to work, who do they want in the room? And then I would bring in like the heads of the intelligence agencies, because it could be that there's this wonderful problem where you've got a terrorist group who were planning some kind of atrocity. And by the way, while you're doing all of this, there's phone calls. You know, you've got the President of the United States. Curiously enough, they tend to get through. And you have to introduce them to the joys of Switch, which is the number 10 switchboard, which not only takes everything from everywhere around the world, but can get you anything anywhere around the world. I mean, they are amazing. They're truly amazing people. And yeah, you've got all of these people coming in, and you've got the Foreign Office giving you a list of phone calls they'd like the Prime Minister to make, or points they'd like the Prime Minister to make when the President phones, of the United States phones, to congratulate them. Say, well, that's fine, President. One thing I'd really like to talk to you about when we have time is boom, boom, boom. You know, there's so the whole briefing bit is big, and you have to work out, can you put this leader off for another day? And then there's, you know, in the middle of it, their mum or their, you know, a relative might want to phone to just say, wow, you know, that's amazing. And you've got to try and balance all of the personal with the high matters of state. And people tend to think it's one or the other, and you, there's only one prime minister, unfortunately, and they have to manage it all.
On this same day as a new prime minister steps through the door of number 10, their predecessor is leaving behind the biggest job of their lives. Moira Wallace remembered this changeover in 1997 from her time as a private secretary in Downing Street.
Obviously, everyone watched the election wherever they watched it and didn't get much sleep and all turned up really early. And it was just a bizarre atmosphere, because you walked down the street and there were loads and loads of Labour supporters whooping outside the gates. And inside, John and Norma Major were preparing to take their farewells. There was a sort of stand around do with bacon sandwiches, I think. And John Major was there. I think Norma was too. And many political colleagues who were about to depart and clearly had been crying and were just, you know, lots of just ordinary colleagues were upset. John Major said, I know the tradition is that, you know, you all stand up in the hall and wave me off, but I'd really rather you didn't, because I don't want to go out there with a lump in my throat, which was rather touching. And he went out and actually looked as relaxed as you possibly could and headed off with the cricket. So I think that worked. There was then a period of, was it 45 minutes, an hour? I can't remember. And then we were all lining up in the hall to receive the Blairs.
I think it's just barbaric in all sorts of ways. I think what we've talked about is incoming prime ministers, but remember the trauma for the person going out. You know, they've been there, it's probably the biggest job they'll have had in their lives, and they're just shunted out, you know, and their team.
Here's Gus O'Donnell again.
I feel for them. You know, they've served the country incredibly well. They've done a really difficult job. And it's very hard for us as civil servants, because they're looking at us going, well, you're not going anywhere, are you? You know, so there's not a lot of sympathy for us, but we definitely have sympathy for them, understand that. So, yeah, I hate the idea of the removal van having to arrive straight away. I wish we could have a 2-3 week period. I don't see any harm in that.
The cabinet is often appointed in the afternoon after a change of prime minister, with junior ministers appointed over the following days. It is in some ways the most visible part of a change of government, with new ministers coming in and out of number 10. But as Moira Wallace remembers from 1997, it doesn't always go exactly to plan.
Alex Allen and Jonathan Powell and a few of us private secretaries went off somewhere to start planning the formation of the government. And so it all set off, and people were called in and given jobs that in most cases didn't surprise them, but in a few cases did. And then they went out and, you know, were spotted and shouted at by the cameras and journalists. And that sort of played out all afternoon. And I don't know, about 5:30, we just gathered round Alex's desk to see how we were doing, how far down our list we'd got. And one of my colleagues very earnestly said, Alex, what's the thinking behind not appointing a Secretary of State for X? I won't name what X was. And Alex went, oh, shit. And he was obviously just forgotten. This had somehow or other fallen down. So a Secretary of State for X was appointed. But I sort of quote that because it's an example of a day when you didn't quite know what was intentional or part of the new world and what was complete accident.
Polly McKenzie was Nick Clegg's Director of Policy. She remembers being in number 10 as the 2010 cabinet was appointed.
I remember that they gave us shepherd's pie and chocolate brownies. Cameron was appointing his cabinet, and every individual cabinet member after they were appointed was shown up to see Nick afterwards. He had a great chat with Ken Clark. Those were one-to-ones in the next door room, but he would sort of come back and talk to the fewer of us who were around. Danny Alexander was there as well. And nobody else ate the shepherd's pie or the chocolate brownies, but I did. And they were really good, which is a shame because most of the catering in Downing Street is, I was expecting more after that experience, but they really pulled out the big stuff for the first day.
A changing government sees each Whitehall department get a new political leader overnight. Ed Balls was a special advisor to Gordon Brown in 1997. He'd spent months speaking to Treasury officials about how a new Labour government would want to run the department, and told us how he was even in touch with them on polling day itself.
So I started the day by meeting the Permanent Secretary to the Treasury, Terry Burns, in Whitehall at about 10:30 in the morning. And we'd been talking and meeting for a good year and a half. But we were very cautious about handing over documents. And he was cautious about receiving them, but they wanted to be able to make a start. So there was a bunch of policy papers, which I'd promised to give him. And I handed them to him in a brown envelope just outside the Treasury, opposite the Red Lion. I actually met one of the guys who we'd worked with, who turned up with a brown envelope. And then I put his brown envelope into my brown envelope. It was all very furtive. And then I then went to the atrium and had lunch with Charlie Whelan to reflect upon the fact that this was probably the quietest day we were going to have for the coming months and years.
Ed Balls' partner, Yvette Cooper, was first elected in Labour's 1997 landslide. She and Ed Balls would go on to be cabinet ministers together under Gordon Brown as Prime Minister.
I got the train up to Yorkshire and saw the exit poll with Yvette at the place we were staying, and then went with her to her count. And then at about 12:30, probably after her count, I got into a car with a TGWU driver, and we drove all the way down. And the thing I remember was him yelling very loudly somewhere on the M1 south of Leicester. And that was the moment when Michael Portillo lost and Stephen Twigg won, and he couldn't contain himself.
Gordon Brown was all set to become Chancellor in a new Labour government. So after attending the post-election victory party, Ed Balls headed over to the department to get started.
I then went back to the Treasury at about 10 in the morning and met Terry Burns again and went up to the Chancellor's waiting room. And they gave me all of the bound documents for the Chancellor. And I sat in this waiting room with a television and watched the procession of cabinet ministers going into Downing Street and Gordon Brown doing that eventually while reading all of the briefs. And then went down with Terry when Gordon Brown arrived later in the afternoon.
Not all shadow ministers will be so sure of the role they might have in government, even when they've spent years building up experience of a particular brief. This can be true right up to when they're walking through the number 10 door to meet the new Prime Minister, as Harriet Harman remembers from 1997.
I didn't actually know what department I was going into, and some people didn't know what departments they were going into. And ironically, the drivers did know which department we were going into. So basically, when I was driving off with my driver to my department, which is actually bonkers because it was just the other side of the road, but he said, that's X. He thinks he's going to Y department, but actually he's going to Z department. So the drivers knew who the cabinet was because they had to know which department to take them to. And I think that's bonkers in a way. The idea that you don't know which department you're going to be going into, I think it doesn't make sense. But I suppose really prime ministers want to keep the power in their hands to make last minute changes. But that, from the point of view of the person who's going into the department, and you don't even really know which department you're going into. I mean, imagine if you're the person who's not even been the shadow in that department, you suddenly walk in. Yeah, that is tough.
For the civil service, the appointment of the new cabinet can bring surprises too. Unless they also hear from the drivers, the departments won't necessarily know which ministers they're getting, or what else might change for them with the new government in charge. 2010 saw the formation of the first UK coalition government since World War II. Moira Wallace was permanent secretary at the Department for Energy and Climate Change.
We had a surprise false alarm. Word reached us that along with the appointment of Chris Hume, there was going to be some change to the department's boundaries, some change to the dividing line between us and DEFRA. And because our formation in 2008 had been incredibly ad hoc, and for ages our department had been marked by a sort of laminated piece of A4 blue tack to the front of the building, I told my senior team there was a chance now that the name of the department might change in some way. And I said, if that happens, I do hope that we can improve on the laminated A4 that we had last time. And that was my throwaway remark. And a few hours later, we got the call from number 10. Yes, it's definitely Chris Hume. And I said, is there a change of name or functions? No, that's not going to happen. Okay, so I told my senior team, went down to greet Chris Hume and discovered two workmen removing the name of the department from the front of the building because my suggestion that we do better if we were being renamed and have a proper sign had been acted on instantly. And there was a sort of strong smell of solvent and there was nothing I could do. The sign had disappeared and our head of press was there tearing his hair out with me. So how were we to demonstrate to the cameras that Chris Hume was shaking hands with me in front of the Department of Energy and Climate Change? Well, it turned out that we had sliding energy efficient doors. And if they were shut, there was a sort of logo on the glass doors that said Department of Energy and Climate Change. So we had a very complicated arrangement that those doors had to be jammed shut while Chris Hume and I shook hands. And then our head of communications, without getting in shot himself, had to work out from our body language when we were going to go up the steps and go in, and magically make the doors open again. And that was what happened.
As well as the rolling cameras outside number 10 and photos in front of departments, the way teams work on the inside can change, as Nick McPherson remembers from his time as Principal Private Secretary to the Chancellor in 1997.
The cultural change was massive. To illustrate that, on day two, I think it was a bank holiday weekend because of the May Day bank holiday, I thought I would break the habit of a lifetime and get up really early and get into Treasury so that we were all ready for Mr. Brown to turn up for his second day at the Treasury. Got there, I think, shortly after 8 o'clock in the morning, which by Ken Clark's standards was incredibly early. Ken Clark had a rule, which was not to do breakfast meetings, and generally turned up to the office at about 9:30 every morning. And I mean, he'd been a minister for 18 years. He kind of knew what mattered. And at least for much of his early life as minister, he tended to stay out late, going to Ronnie Scott's and so on. I'm not sure he was still going to Ronnie Scott's in 97, but I get there at 8 o'clock to discover that Gordon Brown had been in there since 5:30 a.m. and that indeed a security guard had had to find some keys to open up the Chancellor's office.
And early starts weren't the only change Treasury officials had to get used to.
The other indicator which became pretty clear fairly quickly is Gordon Brown, apart from eating large amounts of bananas, you know, he didn't really eat during the day. He just worked. And again, I do remember him saying, well, what did Ken Clark do for lunch? And I'd say, well, quite often we'd go to the pub. And you could just tell, sort of, Gordon Brown on one hand wanted to sort of indicate that he might want to go to the pub too, but this was just so alien to his being that it was never going to happen.
Government frequently, perhaps too frequently, sees reshuffles of ministers and changing faces leading departments. But a new party in power can mean a more profound change, as Moira Wallace told us from her time in Number 10 in 1997.
It was incredibly different in every conceivable way. First of all, it was very cheerful. You know, here were a group of people who had been engaged in a task for both a year and decades, and they'd achieved it. And they were incredibly cheerful and satisfied, and they were very drilled as a team. And that was the exact opposite of what we'd been experiencing, and that had frustrated John Major so much that there wasn't a lot of team behaviour in the outgoing government. So it was just, that was a complete contrast. But of course, it was completely different in social makeup. So, you know, throughout my time in Number 10, obviously the government was composed, you know, very heavily slanted towards the south of England, quiet male, quiet public school, not many MPs from Scotland, from the north of England. And suddenly that was all flipped around. So it was a very different group of people from different parts of the country who had different professional backgrounds, who'd been to state schools, there were more women, very different and very confident.
Harriet Harman remembers the record-breaking number of new female MPs elected in 1997 and how it felt like government had also changed, at least at first.
When Margaret Thatcher left office, there was an all-male cabinet, and that was not an unusual situation. So it was a big cultural change just to have all those women there. It was the critical mass, and that changed a lot. And those women started supporting women in the civil service and amongst women special advisors and amongst women political editors. And there was like a resistance to the male hegemony across the piece. But as you get nearer to power, the male hegemony creeps back. You know, opposition is looser woven. There's a very tight weave for power. And at that point, suddenly, there seem to be more men around, weirdly. Opposition, plenty of space for women. When you get to actually pulling the levers, blimey, suddenly the men appear from out of every crevice and seem to be holding the levers. So at that point, you know, women have to man up, if that's not a contradiction in terms.
When a new team enters government, they have to decide how they'll work and how they want to organise themselves. One thing that comes up again and again when you speak to people who have worked in Number 10 is the importance of where people sit. Here's David Cameron's former Deputy Chief of Staff, Kate Fall.
So I think it does feel rather odd to wake up and think I've got to go to work and my office is Number 10. And then there is only the front door you are allowed to go in. So you are walking in front of that bank of cameras thinking, did I brush my hair? And of course, coming in into that amazing entrance hall and the corridor, not knowing, you know, where my desk is going to be. And I basically sort of put my Pret coffee down outside the door of the Prime Minister's office because I thought, well, someone's got to sit here. It might as well be me. Ed Llewellyn, the Chief of Staff, opposite me. So that was definitely a sort of a big learning curve. That was the strangest thing of all.
One of the things that people sometimes fail to realise is quite how important rooms are in circumstances like this.
Here's Jonathan Powell, former Chief of Staff to Tony Blair.
You know, Number 10 is a completely unsuitable place to be running government from. It really is. It's an old country house that's falling apart at the seams. It's not got the right size rooms for offices or anything else, really. I was a firm advocate of moving out actually into the QE2 centre, where you can have van offices, but no one was buying that. Everyone wants to go through the front door of Number 10. So proximity is power in politics. So you want to sit near the leader. So in the White House, people will sacrifice a huge palatial office in the old executive office building only 150 yards away for a tiny cubbyhole in the West Wing if they could be near the president and summoned by him. So I had to arrange the various staff in different rooms. Had I tried to negotiate it once we went in, we'd never have agreed.
For Harriet Harman, it wasn't just the Number 10 building that caused problems. She told us how the whole setup of Whitehall made ministers suddenly feel removed from each other.
One of the things that was talked about before we went in 97 as to whether we would turn the Treasury building into a department for ministers and that all the ministers would be in there and we would then all talk to each other all the time and there would be no departmental silos and no departmental turf wars. And the first thing that happens when you get into government is you stop talking to your political colleagues and you only talk to your team, your junior ministers and your civil servants. And therefore you lose the bigger picture unless you're in Number 10. And that I think is really problematic because you need to solve political problems together. That's how we'd worked in opposition for 15 years. I used to be popping into Gordon and Tony's office and my other colleagues all the time. Suddenly in government, you can't do that. And then you realise, actually, how much your whole way of working is predicated on that cooperation, and that's gone.
Harriet Harman told us how the realities of government changed her relationship with Tony Blair, someone she'd worked closely with in opposition for over 15 years.
Tony then is not just Tony, who I'd been sort of hanging out with since the early 1980s, but he was Prime Minister. He was running the country. And all your relationships change. That's the other thing. And I remember one of my spads saying to me, Tony's not your friend. I'd mentioned Tony being my friend. And he said, Tony's not your friend. He's the Prime Minister. And he was trying to tell me something very profound, which is when you get into government, all your relationships change because you've got on your shoulders the responsibility of government. And the only thing that Tony had to do was run the country, not be my friend.
Moira Wallace was a civil servant during both the 1997 and 2010 transitions of power and watched new political teams getting used to the ways of working in government.
There's such a difference from moving from a small team that is campaigning into something that is then sitting at the top and through the structure of government and can not just make announcements, but make things happen. And those things may have ramifications for other bits of the government. And it really takes a while for any government, those at the centre, those in other roles, to work out what can I in my bit do without consultation and when do I need to consult and why. There was clearly a change to a much more informal method of communication. And to some extent, that's no bad thing, that there were people just texting each other and calling each other up. They'd worked so closely. Why were they suddenly going to be told they had to start writing letters to each other?
Ed Balls came into the Treasury from opposition as a special advisor to Gordon Brown.
In 1997, the Treasury worked very hard on understanding the intellectual transition. But I think that they didn't do brilliantly at the change in the method of working. Gordon Brown, Tony Blair and the senior cabinet people and we didn't behave in a formal, hierarchical, meetings-based, sit around, make a decision and then move on to the next meeting. It was much more fluid than that. First of all, we didn't write really anything down, hardly, and we certainly didn't send any emails. I'd never written an email in my life professionally. That wasn't how we communicated. That was still a very early technology. The Treasury was ahead of the game. And we were very cautious about big meetings and written papers. And so I think for Gordon, the cultural shock of seeing all this detail written down in leakable form being discussed in a meeting of 25 people, that was a big culture shock. Quite quickly, we dispensed with that because Gordon just sort of clammed up in that big forum.
Sally Morgan entered Downing Street in 1997 as Tony Blair's political secretary. She told us how the new number 10 team got to grips with the different ways of working in government.
The complexity and the amount of stuff, I think, is mind-blowing when you first go in. And I don't think we had thought, well, we definitely hadn't thought, and it was a while before we worked out how to organise things so that Tony's week ran properly and that there was proper follow-through. It's very easy in capacities and lots of things, but it's particularly easy in government to think you've done something because you've put a tick on a piece of paper. So that's done with. You then realise actually not very much has happened as a result of that. So it took us a while both for him to be in a position where he started to do a weekly note, a Monday morning meeting. And we then reached a stage, I can't remember when it was, but sometime into government where we then started to effectively do a note back on a Friday to say, these are the things we talked about and this is where we've got up to. Because he was finding it difficult to track. Where was the progress on some of the big issues?
The move from opposition into government is fundamentally about finally having power. But for those who come into the centre of government after years of opposition, it can be surprising how difficult it is to make things happen. Here's Tony Blair's former Chief of Staff, Jonathan Powell.
I wish I'd realised, and maybe I should have done, how few power levers of power actually existed, number 10 Downing Street. Downing Street has no budget to speak of, very few civil servants. And those are the two elements of power in a government department. The only way the Prime Minister exercises any influence is his ability to sack people or appoint them. And he has to actually work to make anything happen. He has to build a coalition with the ministers he wants to do things with, the civil servants, with the public. So it's a job of persuasion. And we have this idea in Britain that somehow the Prime Minister is all powerful and it's terrible and he should be constrained. My experience was the opposite. Come into number 10, you pull on these levers and they're connected to absolutely nothing. And there definitely are changes that need to be made at the centre.
The Prime Minister's Chief of Staff is key to organising the centre of the new government. In 2010, the Conservatives benefited from having a Chief of Staff who was already familiar with how government worked. Here's Kate Fall.
None of us had ever been into number 10 before, apart from Ed Llewellyn, so he did know his way round.
Ed Llewellyn was a diplomat who'd previously worked for the Conservative Party under Thatcher and Major.
He had an idea of also what it would be like in terms of, especially on the national security side, which was his expertise. So I think that was incredibly helpful. I think Labour will find it helpful to have someone like Sue Gray who literally knows where to sit, how to organise things. And also some things that I didn't know when I went to number 10, for example, how the poll box system works. You have papers, submissions going into the Prime Minister. You have to make sure you're on that list. And then it took me 2 weeks to realise that I wasn't on the return of these documents where the Prime Minister had written what he thought, and then you get a copy of that if you're allowed. And that's why everyone seemed to know what the Prime Minister thought about things. I kept thinking, have I missed something? So, I mean, it's incredible what you don't know.
One big change for any new government is working alongside civil servants, as Jonathan Powell told us.
I think a problem we ran into, and I would warn people coming into government to think about this, was we had quite an effective guerrilla operation by the time we finished in opposition. Very small, very light. And we kind of transposed that into number 10 and didn't really integrate it with the civil servants quickly enough. And Tony complained to me after a while that the machinery of government felt like a nice shiny Rolls Royce parked outside number 10 he wasn't allowed to drive. But after about 6 months, I'd say we did then manage to integrate properly with the Cabinet Office. And it was after that we then started thinking about changes in the machinery of government.
Kate Fall also found this to be a big adjustment in 2010.
There is an immediate tension between a tight political team who have worked together for a long time, trust each other, just won an election, walking into a number 10, especially if they've served a government which was of a different party, but even if it's the same party. And I think that's a difficult moment for both sides. I mean, we quite quickly learnt to get on very well. We always had a strong relationship with our civil service. I thought our team at number 10 were some of the most fantastic, most professional people I've worked with. But there is a little bit of getting to know each other. And of course, there's one side calling the Prime Minister PM or Prime Minister, and there's the other side who is still going David or whatever. There is a sense of professionalisation, and then you sort of learn to maybe just call them the Prime Minister, at least in those meetings. So that's just a symbolic point, but I think it speaks to the wider thing that it is two teams coming from a different background, but over time coming together to run in parallel.
After an election, a Chancellor will often hold a budget to set out their plans early on. This is a massive exercise and requires political teams and civil servants to work very closely together.
It was a huge policy and cultural challenge, because there was so much to each side to learn about how to do things and how each other worked.
Ed Balls remembers how working with officials to prepare for Labour's first budget in 1997 was a big adjustment, particularly when it came to the Chancellor's Budget Day speech.
For Gordon Brown, this speech was his first speech as Chancellor. And Gordon's words were always important to him. And I think if you're an opposition politician, your words are what you have. You know, you don't have decisions really, but you have what you say. So he worked for weeks. He was in continual session speech writing, and our job was to do everything else. And then we would go in and out with the senior officials at different points. You know, we're going to do this on petrol tax, this on tobacco tax. But we then got to the day before the budget, and the Chancellor's speech writer, who's the Chief of Government Advisor to Treasury now, Sam Backett, handed over to Gordon and us that morning the draft of the speech he'd written. And we didn't know anything about this because Ken Clark basically would get his speech the day before and make corrections in hand. And that was his speech. And it had in it no message and no rhetoric. How could they possibly have written a speech with any message or rhetoric? They had no idea. I mean, they just had the manifesto, but it had every measure in it. And then it turned out Gordon Brown, in this kind of weeks of working on this budget speech, I mean, he had great message. His first line was about Britain, a kingdom united in name only, was his kind of opening thing for this budget. But he didn't have any of the measures in it at all. I mean, he didn't put any of the policy in. And I kind of went in and said, look, I have a problem with your speech, Gordon, because you haven't put any of the policy in. He said, but it's all really unpopular. Why do I want to say any of this? And I said, because you're the Chancellor. And if you don't say it, doesn't happen. So we had this terrible day from about lunchtime right through until about 3 a.m, where we had 2 different speeches, the one which had the measures in, which Gordon didn't like, and the one he had written, which didn't have any measures in. And we had to basically blend them. And so we had to call over all these senior officials who came over from Customs and Revenue and the Treasury into this meeting room next door. And me and Sam and Ed Miliband and Nick McPherson would move between the two. And we would say, Gordon, they say you've got to say this. Ridiculous. I can't say any of this. It's all absurd. He would then write a version. We would then iterate. When we got something which felt like it was right, we would have to print it out, go through into the other room and get them to agree whether or not it actually was true. And of course, so much cascades on budget day from the speech and the words through the press releases and as well as the documentation. The document was fine because we'd done that, but the speech couldn't be out of line. I think it's about 3 a.m. So we never made that mistake again.
But crafting the speech wasn't the only challenge Brown's team faced with Labour's first budget.
The other kind of interesting cultural thing, which I think just kind of captures in a way that cultural difference. We'd been used to in opposition doing budgets. So we knew how budgets worked and how they unraveled. And we couldn't let that happen. So the budget speech is done. Back then, it would have been in the middle of the afternoon. And then you have this whole kind of media thing. And then by about 5 or 6, start to become problems. Do we fully know the answer to this question? We're being challenged on that. And so we would say, can we get the relevant officials round? They'd all gone to a party. The Treasury held a party in number 11 Downing Street on the afternoon of the budget to thank everybody for their work. And as far as we were concerned, we were sort of right in the eye of the storm. So me and Nick would say, get the capital gains tax people. They're all at the party. So all these people had to keep coming back with their drinks in hand from number 11 Downing Street back into the Treasury to brief the Chancellor. So we realised after that day that it was good to have a party, but the party should be the day after. It should be on the Thursday night if it was a Wednesday budget. And everybody knew that Wednesday evening we were still doing the budget. And until you'd got to Parliament the next morning and you'd seen the first round of what the difficult issues were, you know, everybody was still at work. And that is just, it was just a different mindset of how politically on it you were from a media point of view. I just think we were so steeped in that. That's what we did.
The civil service has to both deliver for a new team in government, but also continue to challenge policy proposals.
I think they have to establish their credentials with the incoming government. And there's always a danger, because there's a balance for civil servants between warning about elephant traps, not letting ministers fall into the same traps that other ministers have fallen into before, and yet looking can-do and can get things actually moving in the way the minister wants.
Here's Jonathan Powell again.
I think getting that balance right between a can-do approach when ministers come in, but not forgetting their duty to warn of the dangers, because ministers will not thank you if you let them straight into an elephant trap that's perfectly obvious to everyone else, but not to them. So it's a difficult balance for civil servants to get, but I think over time that should be possible for people to do. And to try it, it's a bit like what I do now working with terrorists. What you try to do is build trust.
Once a new team has entered government, they want to hit the ground running to deliver their priorities, putting into practice the plans they made in opposition, now they're finally in power. For the new Labour government, one major policy announcement within days of coming into power was Bank of England independence, as Ed Balls and Maura Wallace explain.
We had, on the Friday, arrived and given Terry Burns the letter for the governor about Bank of England independence. Although we talked about Bank of England many times, we hadn't revealed to him what our plan was, and I think he was expecting a much slower track. But we presented him with his letter, and he said, fine, we're on it. They called in this young civil servant called Tom Scholar, who worked overnight to write the papers, and the Treasury Management Board had an immediate meeting. They all went into meetings to discuss it. And then the next morning, Gordon and I went up to see Tony Blair at his flat in Islington. And, you know, at least Gordon had made it to the Treasury. I mean, Tony Blair was still working from home. I don't think he'd quite accepted that he was the Prime Minister yet and should go to Downing Street. So we had this meeting in the sofa, and quite a lot of it was about personnel issues. But Tony did have his private secretary there, Moira Wallace. And Tony said, you know, there'd been a long discussion about other things. And Tony said, oh, by the way, he said, we talked on Thursday, bank independence, when are you doing it? And Gordon said, we're going to bring the meeting forward. We'll do it immediately Tuesday morning because we don't want to have any market moments. And they said, fine. And Moira Wallace said, if I understand, you're proposing to make the Bank of England independent.
So I played my role of the nerdy civil servant and sort of said to the Prime Minister, who I hadn't had a chance to chat to about this, don't you want a paper or something on this? Is it going to go to Cabinet? And the Prime Minister just looked at me and said, well, I think if Gordon says it's all right, it's going to be all right.
And that was it. That was the collective discussion. And then we were off. And I don't think that the machine fully appreciated the depth of trust and commonality, which there was.
And I thought, okay, that was the wrong thing to say. But actually, this was still an enormous announcement that the rest of the cabinet did need to know about and had several elements to it, which became quite delicate in the coming weeks. You know, I felt, gosh, I'm not really sure I added any value in that conversation, but nonetheless, it needed to be said. And so for anybody doing this in future, I'm there with you when you have to be the person who raises an awkward point and everyone stares at you. But actually, I think I did the right thing, possibly not in the right way, but
Challenging and testing government policies is an important role for civil servants. And this particular incident didn't seem to hold Moira Wallace back. As we heard earlier, she went on to become permanent secretary at the Department for Energy and Climate Change. One of the big policy moments for a new government is the King's Speech. This normally happens about 2 weeks after the election and sets out the new laws a government wants to pass through Parliament in the year ahead. Like other key moments in the first weeks after an election, this requires preparation. Here's former Cabinet Secretary Gus O'Donnell.
It's detailed and it always comes with everybody needing to think about actually those things they thought about. Do they really want to do it through legislation? And are there some things that they thought they could do in other ways, but they actually, their departments told them they need primary legislation for?
Sally Morgan told us how careful planning for the weeks and months after the election allowed the new Labour government to hit the ground running once they gained power.
We wanted some big headline, eye-catching noise to show that things were different. So obviously, Bank of England independence, huge. And we had a few big policies. So I do think the national minimum wage was one of those big ones. And I think we also wanted to demonstrate in the first 100 days, we were kicking off the pledges. So here were the things we said we were going to be elected on. We have started the work on this. So, you know, whatever you could do, you would get going on. But there had to be announcements around it. So we gridded announcements and moving those things forward, I think. I think what we didn't understand, not so much about the first 100 days, but probably the first year, was how much political capital you actually have then. And I think you only look back and think, oh, you know, you learn how to do government better the longer you're in, but you've got less capital to do the things that you need to do. So, you know, that's the balance. I think any government probably says that, and we all pass it, and nobody ever quite believes it until you're in and you understand. You don't understand until you're in. So I think that's difficult. So I think we probably did the first 100 days very well. I think we probably did the first 18 months less well.
Jonathan Powell told us how in 1997, Labour felt it was important to make the most of their political capital, to do the hard things early in their first term in office.
We need to get some of these big announcements out from our 100-day plan and do the Prime Minister's first visit, which was to Northern Ireland, because we wanted to demonstrate that was a real priority. So because we had that 100-day plan and a second 100-day plan, it gave us that political momentum that allowed us to do things like Northern Ireland. If you hadn't done that from a position of strength with political capital at the beginning, you'd never have got the peace process done. And small changes like changing Prime Minister's questions. You know, there used to be two Prime Minister's questions a week at 15 minutes. We consolidated it to one for half an hour, which gave time for the Prime Minister to travel around the country, which otherwise Prime Ministers can't do during parliamentary session because they're going to be there the whole time.
One key question facing a new government is when to hold their first budget. Here's Ed Balls.
We were in a big hurry to get to our first budget because the windfall tax was so important for our kind of our credibility and the manifesto, and it had been such a complicated, tense thing to sort out. And we wanted to get the new deal up and running quickly. And so there was like a real imperative for the first budget. And when you talk to George Osborne, they had an imperative to move quickly for the first budget because having tied in the Liberal Democrats into this coalition, they needed to move quickly and bind them in about what they were going to do on spending. But I don't think it is inevitable that the right thing to do is to move quickly for a budget. You have to move quickly with process. But I think there is a lot of opening the books and studying what's going on and understanding that. And, you know, if it hadn't been for the windfall tax, we might have started the spending review and done the budget a little bit later. The budget is a big moment and a big opportunity, but you need to get your timing right.
Labour's preparations before the election were as much about how they were going to work as what they were going to do.
My big point, I think, is that this is not simply about policy, and it's even not mainly about policy, it's about kind of mutual understanding of working methods and people, and not starting on day one with a completely blank canvas in terms of relationships, because that is just hard.
Access talks with the civil service were crucial to their preparations for government, even if in some cases the ministers themselves weren't willing to think beyond the election campaign.
The truth was, Gordon Brown and Tony Blair were both really cautious about the access talks, because I think they were so burned by the 1992 experience, the expectation Labour was going to win. They didn't want themselves, in themselves, or anybody externally to think they were taking anything for granted. And they wanted, in my case, me for Gordon, Jonathan Powell, they wanted us to be doing all this work, and they wanted lots of policy work being done. But I don't think emotionally, as well as politically, they could quite cope with the idea of measuring the curtains. And that's how they would have seen it. And I personally think that's okay.
There was one really rather important meeting that Brown did engage with.
Gordon did have one meeting with Terry, which Terry came along. I think by far the most important thing in the meeting was probably about 9 months later. Terry came along with three different examples of font size, because, you know, everybody knew Gordon had an eyesight challenge, and he chose Arial 16 point. And from that moment on, for the next decade, that was the font.
Whoever's in power after the coming election, they'll face challenging circumstances. A struggling economy, geopolitical instability, failing public services, and growing distrust in politicians. The final word in this series goes to former special advisor and cabinet minister, Ed Balls. Here's his advice for the next government.
If you're an opposition politician, your words are really all you have. You know, you don't really take decisions, but you do have what you say. In government, it's so different. There, you're making decisions. You can deliver on your priorities. Of course, you're judged by results, not words, but you can change things. In government, you have power.
Thanks for listening to this sixth and final episode of Preparing for Power, a podcast series from the Institute for Government. We hope you've enjoyed this series, and if you're preparing for power or are preparing to work with whoever's in government after the election, we hope you found it useful. You can listen to all six episodes in the series on our website, iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from. If you'd like to find out more about how an incoming government can make Number 10 and the Treasury work for them, read our new Commission on the Centre of Government, out now. And head to our website if you'd like to find out more about how the civil service, governing party and opposition prepare for a general election, and what comes after. Thanks for listening.